Duff, good morning.
Morning, Dan. How are you?
I'm pretty good. What's new in Westchester?
Rain, lots of it today. The rainy season's back again. Hopefully the basement doesn't flood this year.
Are you near the house in Scarsdale that blew up?
No, actually, I haven't even heard of that.
It was a house, a spec house going up in Scarsdale. It's on the market for $2.4 million, and I think something got screwy with the gas line, and it exploded yesterday. So now it's on the market for $3 million now.
It's a real estate metaphor for the capital markets.
Exactly. The reckless behavior contributing to a blow-up that has the effect of depressing real estate prices in the New York City suburbs and causing a great amount of angst among suburban housewives.
Exactly.
Speaking of angst, did you watch the hearings yesterday?
I watched a little bit of them and read the follow-up to them, yeah.
So I'm still not sure what to make of this. To me, the most intriguing part is, you know, the role of the federal government in essentially setting a price for the acquisition of Bear Stearns. So a lot of the testimony yesterday centered around how it was that Bear Stearns got into trouble and how this deal was engineered over the weekend, where the Fed or the Treasury essentially said, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase, you buy it and the price will be $2 a share. And, of course, that was later jacked up. What's your sense of your best sense of how that went down? Who came up with that price?
Well, when I was in, I actually spoke to Jamie Dimon in his office on that Monday.
Would that have been for your cover essay in New York Magazine last week?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Wait, we have a copy here, I think. Yes, we do. There you go. And basically, I asked him a question that had been on my mind over the weekend, which was, how can we trust Wall Street to value anything if something that was 170 a year ago and, you know, 30 on the Friday close became 2 a day later? And he said to me a little cryptically, it wasn't that kind of valuation. And I said, oh, so what kind of valuation was it? And he said something that he said in his testimony yesterday, which was that J.P. Morgan wasn't going to do this deal unless it knew that it had coverage on its downside. So basically pay nothing ultimately in order that they can absorb any losses. And so my final question to him was, well, if it was that kind of valuation, why didn't you just offer them $1 a share? He kind of smiled, and I think what he was suggesting by his non-response to that was that, you know, that would have been an even greater insult than $2 a share. So I think the two ultimately ended up being, you know, as low as they could go without you know, causing Bear Stearns people to actually rip their computers out of the walls and throw them out the windows.
Right, but, you know, some of the reporting, obviously the price was arbitrary to a degree. Some of the reporting that came out seemed to indicate that they might have been willing to pay more, but the $2 price came in part from Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who said, was essentially saying, you know, if you pay a higher price, because the difference between $2 a share and 5 or 6 was really a few $100 million, and for a company the size of J.P. Morgan, doesn't make that much of a difference, especially when you look at the liabilities involved here. But the narrative coming out was that Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, was saying, we got to put a low price on this because we don't want it to seem like the shareholders are getting bailed out.
And I think that's the great debate that's going to rage on here, which is whether the Fed can have it both ways, whether they can have effectively engineered a bailout and be able to say that, but we really didn't, did we, because the Bear Stearns shareholders were effectively wiped out. And, you know, that debate's going to go on and on. You know, there's the stuff that people have been talking about the last couple of days of, if the Fed actually has some upside on its guaranteed loans? Are they not actually an equity investor and not even just a guarantor? So I think my opinion of this is that I actually think it was probably prudent of the Fed to step in for fear of what the alternative was, which could have been a cascading series of defaults. But they certainly can't come out of it saying that we're back to business as usual, because they did do something extremely unprecedented, right?
And to me, the most comical aspect of this was that on the, this is going back a couple of weeks now, but when the deal was announced that, I think that Monday morning for $2 a share, which was a shock to everybody, not least to all the people at Bear Stearns, you know, the board, I think, hired Lazard, their advisor, to give a quote-unquote fairness opinion, which is basically, I think, a rubber stamp. And they said, yeah, $2, that sounds like a good price, that's fair. And then when people went nuts, and a few days later, J.P. Morgan came back and said, you know what, we'll pay 10, five times that amount. Lazard turned around and said, you know what, that's fair too.
So again, how can we trust these guys to value anything?
I think we should let the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Secretary render fairness opinions. I'm sure they charge a lot less. And, you know, the strangest thing, you know, there's all this... I think one of the bizarre things that's going on and bewildering is the way in which the Fed and Treasury, but really the Fed, is increasing its sort of purview almost on a daily basis. From, you know, it's supposed to worry about price stability and maintaining full employment and using monetary policy to affect that, and it's supposed to regulate the banks. And here we've had in recent weeks these extraordinary efforts to, you know, provide financing to banks to help provide liquidity to the mortgage markets by accepting mortgages as collateral in a way it didn't in the past, and now basically providing boutique investment banking services, providing advisory advice. They've now taken on this portfolio of $29 or $30 billion in assets from Bear Stearns that I believe they've hired an outside manager, BlackRock, to manage. So now they're in the, you know, mortgage-backed securities management business. This is all within the space of really 2 or 3 months, without, you know, with very little sort of public debate. There's this sense when you watch some sort of the people on the left in Congress saying, you know, that if they're berating Bernanke, it's not that you've taken the Fed into uncharted territory; it's that you're not doing enough for individuals. There seems to be this consensus that they did what they had to do. It is what it is. Let's move on. And I actually find that a little troubling.
As do I. You know, I was talking to a senior financial services consultant yesterday, and he said, you journalists always love the moments where, you know, there's excessive turmoil in the market and think that it's a very crucial turning point. But he said, if you look back, the market blows up almost every, you know, 5 or 6 years in one way or another, and it's the result of sort of people kind of pushing the boundaries, and it does eat its own. And so there is some argument to be made that Bear Stearns should by rights have been totally wiped out, other than, I guess, what had come to be a consensus at the Fed, that it could be catastrophic to the markets. On the other hand, when you talk about individuals, I'm torn about how we can respond to this. From a selfish perspective, I would have bought a house twice the size of the house that I own had I known that I could have renegotiated my mortgage. So there's that issue. But again, whether or not a wave of foreclosures that is still coming up has material impacts on the economy is something that I guess it is right to debate, you know. If the Bear Stearns was saved because we were worried about its knock-on effects, what are the knock-on effects of a rash of foreclosures? Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Now, what about, you know, you interviewed Diamond. He's a pretty tough interview to get. He's not been the most, I think, has not been the most sort of press-friendly among the Wall Street crowd. And, you know, in every of these crises, and you go back especially through history, there's always been someone who sort of steps in and either stops the bleeding and frequently ends up profiting immensely from them. And then, you know, books get written about them. You know, the vultures who swoop in when things are going to hell, the consolidators. I thought it ironic that J.P. Morgan, or the firm bearing that name, was sort of cast in this role of the bailout this year, because back in 1907, J.P. Morgan himself basically functioned as a sort of one-man Federal Reserve. There was no Federal Reserve. There were monetary issues. The market was going to a panic. And he essentially sort of strode onto the floor of the stock exchange one day and said, you know, this is where the bleeding stops. And he had the capacity to do that, basically to provide liquidity and funding to others, to bring in funding from out of the country, and sort of, you know, that was a kind of signal moment. It made people realize that we needed a Federal Reserve. But it was an example of the sort of, you know, heroic banker stepping into chaos, wading in, stopping the chaos, profiting as a result. A century later, you know, clearly Diamond doesn't fit into that category because, I don't want to say he was timid, but he sort of went and basically said, I will only do this if I have, you know, the backing of the government, essentially. So is he a, you know, do we put him in the realm of the sort of the swashbuckling, sort of public-minded banker who was doing this for the good of the system and hoping to profit at the same time, or as a, you know, sort of cautious manager who just, you know, saw an opportunity and said, okay, my downside is X and my upside is Y?
Well, yeah, I think the latter. I'm not sure I'd call him timid in terms of extracting these guarantees from the Fed, because if you can, why wouldn't you? You know, to not do so would be to be leaving money on the table. So I actually think that you know, Jamie Dimon drove the best bargain he could, and maybe he sensed that he had a timid Fed on his hands and could use them to his advantage. As far as whether he's acting as a public servant or as a private businessman, I think that it's possible that while motivated by selfish means, and by that I mean the interests of J.P. Morgan, that he could also have been performing a public service of sorts. I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. So you know, we had in our New York piece somewhere up at the top, we said it's either, you know, when we look back on the day that deal was struck or restruck, you know, it's either going to be the day Dimon saved Wall Street or the day Dimon pulled off one of the best deals of all time on Wall Street. But it could very possibly be both.
Or it could be a relative blip if there are further and larger blow-ups of, you know, leveraged debt, if some of these giant private equity things go under, and then you have this whole realm of the credit default swaps, the CDS, which I think is going to be the next, you know, acronym that everybody has to learn. We've gone through this cycle where people thought what you needed to know, and I'm talking sort of the general public who may not read the Financial Times every day, they thought the three-letter things you needed to know were sort of IPO, MBA, CEO. Then in you know, last year with all this funky credit stuff, it was CDOs, the collateralized debt obligations. It was the SIVs, which are these, which I think I sort of understand. They were off-balance sheet things that banks set up to invest in debt, that they went bad and caused some trouble. The next thing that people seem to be, you've heard people talking about it, and George Soros, who has this new book out, was railing about it in the Financial Times today, which is the CDS, which are these credit default swaps, which he is arguing, you know, could be the next thing to explode and has a capacity to be a, you know, a larger negative occurrence than some of the things we've seen so far. Do you know anything about credit default swaps?
And well, actually, the interesting thing there is that J.P. Morgan is the leading player in credit default swaps. So when you say it could be a blip, you know, Diamond is walking on a razor's edge here, and he could actually go from hero to goat in the event of some sort of derivatives-led default. Now, it's interesting to point out that in the past year or 9 months or of turmoil that we've been through, interestingly enough, none of this has really been in the realm of derivative securities. You know, you have some the CDOs, there are some synthetic CDOs, which are derivatives, but CDOs are really just packaged debt, as are SIBs. And so while we're in the midst of the greatest market turmoil we've had in a decade, none of it's really derivatives caused. So I think that's part of the reason why people are getting a little obsessed by things like credit default swaps, because you know, the other chaos has already ensued. So what's left? We have this.
Well, maybe we could lay out for our vast viewership. Hi, Mom. What's involved in credit default swaps?
Well, the simplest way to describe them is historically, if you wanted to take a point of view financially on the odds of a company defaulting on its debt or not, you would either buy or sell its actual debt.
Right.
And those markets, you know, while not insubstantial, are not the most liquid. They were never as liquid as equities. And also, the spreads in buying and selling debt tended to be wider. And so someone came up with the notion of a credit default swap, which is actually just a way of isolating the bet on default to its, you know, purest form, and thus created a market in which you could take a position, that same position, without having to actually go out and buy the debt.
Right, but it's a contract between two people. It's I would sell you a default swap that would sort of pay off. Let's say we want the proposition is that Business Week will fail, and that in the event of their failure, I will make good on their debts.
Well, it's not make good on their debts. It's just that, you know, your credit default swap has a range of price, and it'll, you know, it's a 0 to 100 game, right?
Right.
So basically what you have is, you're right, you have two sides. You need someone to take the opposite point of view.
So it's two people making a bet on the solvency of a third party.
Yeah, and taking the opposite sides of that
right.
bet. Now, the one thing that J.P. Morgan has gone to great pains to try and point out is they have trillions of dollars of
right.
what's called notional derivatives exposure.
Yep.
They have billions, if that provides cold comfort, of net derivatives exposure, meaning that a lot of their positions, which they put on for a client, they have hedged out of, or they could have two opposite positions in any particular security.
Right.
So there is some hype involved.
If I'm a hedge fund and I have committed to, you know, paying off in the event of a default, and so there's an unexpected default by a company, I have to pay you 100 cents on the dollar. I don't have that money. What then?
Right. Well, that I think that had something to do with the rescue of Bear Stearns, which was people had, a lot of people. I actually asked Jamie Dimon directly. I said, "Were you motivated to save Bear Stearns because of the exposures that you had with Bear Stearns?" meaning that if Bear defaulted, would J.P. Morgan be sitting there with a bunch of losses on its books? And he said, you know, obviously we had some exposure, but it wasn't the prime motivating factor. So,
and
anyway.
And so now, you know, since the, you know, the first couple days of after the Bear Stearns acquisition, there's obviously a lot of press activity, people hanging around the lobby, you know, the tales of real estate brokers hanging out, giving people their cards because they figured they would need to sell their homes, who had speculation that maybe this would open up some spots in kindergartens around town because the Bear Stearns parents wouldn't be able to afford tuition.
I shouldn't be laughing, but I am. Sorry.
I'm sorry?
I laughed at that, and it's not funny.
Yeah, I don't think it's true, though. They would do a lot other. A lot of other things would have to go first before they start scrimping on the tuition. If you have a slot in one of these preschools or kindergartens, you know the value of it is really vast. And you know, perhaps there should be some sort of secondary market in which you could trade preschool spots.
It's funny. A friend of mine whose kid just got into one of those told me her secret to getting her daughter in the right mood. As before they were going into the audition, she told her they were going to a party.
Uh-huh.
And so the girl was in a great mood, except the jig was almost up when she turned to her mother in the middle of the interview and asked her where the balloons were.
It's a party for which you have to pay $25,000 a year.
Exactly. So someone else told me there was a recent article that Hampton's prices had come down 20% in the past year, so it's time to buy there if you were holding off.
Okay, well, you know what? I'm going to call my broker then because, you know, we're flush here at Newsweek.
I think it's there's an interesting point to be made in terms of the effect on New York City, though, which is kind of what you were alluding to, and you know how much every Wall Street job is worth to the economy. And I'm stretching my memory here, but I think it's for every dollar of Wall Street earnings, you get $4 of service and other industry
right.
earnings. So it's if like layoffs at Bear Stearns are not happening in isolation. I think there was news yesterday that Merrill Lynch maybe laying off up to 7,000 people.
No, but I guess the question
shortly.
I had more was the, you know, Bear Stearns sort of ceasing to exist, but we haven't yet heard, you know, that X thousand people have been told to go home and not come back yet.
I imagine they're just sorting through the resumes. It's you know, we've only had a week or so here, and I think those job the pink slips are going to be handed out at Bear Stearns within, you know, before the end of April. So that's coming down the pike.
And Duff, are you detecting any signs of, you know, as a lazy and lame journalist, I'm always looking for sort of anecdotal things that I could use to illustrate some larger truth that I know to be true, even though the data may not yet confirm it. For example, I've taken to saying that, you know, I live out in Westport, Connecticut, and that this year the parking at the train station seems to be less full. In other words, I think a lot of financial services people or people whose hedge funds didn't work out, either they lost their jobs or they're not going to the city as much, or a lot of these people who are consultants to this industry, there's just not as much activity going on, so they're not going into Stanford, they're not going into New York as much, hence not as many cars, so I don't have to arrive quite so early in order to get my train. Of course, I could just all, you know, be totally misimagining this. It also seems the airports are slightly less crowded. Have you noticed anything either sort of at home or in the city that would sort of betoken a slowdown in Wall Street, the kind of decreased activity, and the sorts of things that have, you know, in some instances made life less pleasant, but also in some instances have sort of kept chunks of the economy going?
Well, it's interesting because Robert Frank, who's the wealth reporter at the Wall Street Journal, had a piece recently on the rash of magazines for the ultra wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was Randall Lane, who runs Double Down Media, there was a piece in the Times on him recently about how they just keep on launching new magazines because they're so targeted. It's a very easy and precise ad sale. So that's a little counter indicator.
Mm-hmm.
Another one I saw, which I wasn't sure which way the effect would be, is the New York Observer pointed out that some of the bars around Grand Central, which is you know right next to Bear Stearns,
right.
It was easier to get up to the bar to order a Guinness. But I was a little confused by that because I might have guessed that it could have been even harder to get up to the bar when you got a bunch of guys drowning their sorrows. So it'd be interesting to pay attention to the flow in those handful of bars out off Vanderbilt there and see.
So probably at lunchtime to go do some reporting.
Yeah, exactly. We'll have to do that if we want to be able to tell a real story here. But I think, you're talking about stuff on the fringe, like, you know, how many customers these... Have you ever heard of the virtual closet where these guys were you...
Is that where Jim McGreevy was?
Yeah.
Here.
Where you... Where they'll deliver whatever suit you want to your house.
Okay.
And so you actually outsource your closet. If we could get a hold of the books of those guys, I imagine you could see business cresting, bottle service, stuff like that. I bet you, even though last week we saw that Manhattan real estate prices once again proved impervious to broader real estate pressures, that we're probably, 2008 has to be a turning point in upward momentum or even flatlining in prices. There's got to be some softening soon.
Well, I predict for this spring and summer a steady stream of articles in New York Magazine, the New York Times, the Observer, to a lesser degree the New York Post, about real estate in the Hamptons, summer homes going begging, timeshares, that whole thing, because it's a topic of obsession, and B, sort of no matter how much it comes down, us journalists and editors will still not be able to afford anything out there. And so there will be a lot of...
Unless you're still doing a share, as if you were still 25. My editor at New York told me that he knows someone in the Hamptons who runs who's got a flower business, you know, doing the sort of big ticket orders for parties and stuff, and her business is off significantly.
Okay.
So at least the decorative arts are suffering in the Hamptons.
Speaking of the Hamptons, there was another topic I didn't really wanted to get to. A couple of years ago, I think it was two summers ago, when hedge funds were all the rage, there was some guys who set up kind of hedge fund hotels out in the Hamptons. In other words, they just tricked out some office space with a bunch of screens so that, you know, people who were taking a week off or coming out there on Fridays could still get a good day's work in. They would come and basically pay for a desk or an office, and they had all the data and all the stuff and whatever services they needed there. Something tells me that space isn't going to be quite as full this year, but you were saying before how in the sort of popular imagination, it seems we don't hear quite as much about hedge funds taking over the world as we used to.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of an indication of what stories seem relevant. You know, when 9 months ago, you couldn't pick up a magazine or a financial magazine without it being a hedge fund cover, and then you see Bloomberg magazine that this month is the author of The Black Swan, which is about sort of unforeseen risk events.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're going to need to see is just like John Paulson and Phil Falcone and a handful of others last year, we're going to need to get the results on, you know, who specifically was shorting Bear Stearns, who called the turn, and there's going to be some results from that world dripping out in time. Now the sort of evil twin to hedge funds, private equity, I think that's going to be a little harder or longer in coming to get some success stories there, because those guys are still grappling with all these deals that are collapsing because the partners won't fulfill their previous obligations.
I also think that I don't want to say the cultural moment for private equity has passed, but the events of the past year have really at once sort of demystified and sort of debunked some of their legend. And by that I mean, Blackstone going public, the vast wealth of Steve Schwarzman and their earnings power and how much he was making. He was the sort of topic du jour. And what we've seen, they, I think, racked up a loss in their most recent quarter. Their stock isn't doing pretty poorly. They've been unable to complete deals at Davos.
Well, the funny thing about these guys, Dan, is that on Wall Street, everyone, and I may have said this last time we spoke, but because it's one of my favorite lines, I think, which is these guys are all geniuses until they're not. Mm-hmm. Like, their genius is only temporary, which suggests that it was not genius at all. But, it's a rare person on Wall Street who has demonstrated the ability over various cycles to consistently and continually profit. And I think what we've seen is, the venture capitalists were genius until the dot-com bubble burst. The private equity guys were geniuses until the liquidity bubble burst. Your friend down the street who was flipping houses in Florida was a genius until he declared bankruptcy because he's sitting on 10 houses he couldn't sell. So in finance, it tends to be that way. There's very few people who are actually, consistently able to see into the future.
It also points up the sort of utter trendiness. I mean, perhaps Men's Vogue should be doing more financial coverage because the styles seem to come in and out very quickly. When I was at Davos in January, have I mentioned that I went to Davos in January?
No. I didn't see you there. I wasn't there.
Davos is this ski resort where the global elite come together and then they invite, let the journalists come and sort of peer in through the glass window. Everybody was there, but there was a panel that I saw Steve Schwarzman on, and no one really wanted to ask him any questions because the panel was all these sovereign wealth funds people who were the hot topic du jour of this year, whereas a year ago, all anybody wanted to hear from was what the private equity people thought of the world because they were dominating everything. Fast forward a year, it was the sovereign wealth funds of China and the Persian Gulf who were, they had the money, they're doing the deals, they're the ones everyone wants to know about, they're the sort of the popular kids, and I'm sure next year it's going to be somebody completely different, some other class of people.
Although I don't see the price of oil coming down anytime soon, so I imagine sovereign wealth funds have a little more staying power than just the last year.
Maybe two things related to financial media. One is, we've seen a slew. Have you been tempted to put together a book proposal on the financial meltdown or generally what's going on? I think there's been probably every book editor knew that there's something going on, something in the air that they don't completely get. Just as after the dot-com bubble burst, all those books were signed up. So were you tempted to try to cobble something together?
No comment. The reason that I need to leave here soon is to go to a meeting in the city, but I can't really tell you what it's about. So, yes.
Good. Good for you. We've seen a few of the big ones have been signed. Charles Gasparino, who used to be here at Newsweek, now at CNBC, has signed one up, and Cohen, the guy who did the ex-Lazard banker who wrote the big book about Lazard, is also doing one as well. And I think, historically, the ones that are sort of the boardroom narratives, because they you know, it takes a while to do a book, and then it takes a while to publish it. And the news cycle moves so quickly that I think it's very difficult for publishers and reporters to do these well if they are providing the sort of tick-tock of, okay, this went wrong then, this went wrong then. So if you are putting your proposal together, my advice would be to get some, you know, to the extent it illuminates something larger about what's happening in the culture, is, I think, more interesting and more has more sort of power in the marketplace.
But yeah, I actually, I agree with you. I thought it was a little shocking that that Bear Stearns book deal got done, considering that people are going to be sick of it by the end of this month.
Correct.
And whether we need to read about it in a year and a half is another issue, but you know, who am I to question the judgment of publishers?
Well, also, it's also that with the, you know, with blogs like Dealbreaker, with Portfolio, with all the, you know, the volume of business coverage that we have today, so many of the details, you know, come out rather quickly. It's not like it was when you had Barbarians at the Gate back, you know, in the late 80s, where so much of this information was sort of closely held, and it took a book and that type of reporting to introduce a lot of these personalities and get details about them.
Yeah, you're right, but on the other hand, you know, who's to criticize people for you know, aiming high? You know, maybe you know, some of those books do come out with some degree of frequency, and that's the nature of that game, to try and be the one who stands out. So hopefully we never get to a point where people say, you know, well, you've got blogs and papers and magazines, and
right, who needs
and,
books?
You know, why even try? Whether collectively it's a profitable enterprise, that's a different issue. But, you know, when you get your hits, I think the hits justify the duds in publishing almost in the same way as in they did in the record industry, if that still is the case. I don't even know.
So, in the last thing, and then I'll let you run to your meeting. I've been very pleasantly surprised by the Wall Street Journal post-Murdoch, especially their Section A coverage. I think their political coverage, the way it covers sort of the links between business and politics, they're doing a lot better than sort of the Post and the New York Times. And I'm finding myself reading, especially the front section, with a lot more attention. And that's been, a pleasant surprise to see someone, you know, there's all this concern about Murdoch, what he would do to the journal. I think it's been a really, I don't know if it speaks to Murdoch or to sort of the quality of the editors that they have there now, but I've been very pleasantly surprised by what's going on there.
And also give an assist to just the news of the day. It things have been pretty exciting. I agree. I used to get the journal in print form, and actually I just dreaded it whenever I picked it up. It was just, you know, another chore that I was going to have to deal with that day. I switched to online receipt of the journal a couple years back, and now it's actually, you know, one of the more pleasant parts of my morning. You know, I'll read page 6 and some of the business coverage in the New York Post online as well, and then actually sit back and go through the journal. So I definitely agree. It's been politically, in particular, you're right, but even the business coverage, I think, is, you know, their bread and butter stuff. It's still on, and they're focused there, and, you know, kudos to them, because it's become a... I think more readable than it has been historically, which is always a good thing.
All right, well, on that note, I'll let you catch your train and get off to your book deal.
All right, thanks, Dan. Good talking to you.
All right, take it easy.